today, theological ends, ethical means, and me.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
Well, I can't really do justice to introduce this topic. I just can't do it justice. There are so many things motivating this conversation for me. I know we won't be able to arrive at all the conclusions I want to get to in one, not only one episode, but actually in this one series. I will come back to it a few times, probably over the next few weeks or months. But for right now, a couple of episodes at least to talk about this issue, where some theological realities that I've lived with my entire Christian life, as long as I've thought about these topics, and that's probably going back to when I was 9 years old, the way those have come together with some realizations, especially over the last 10 years, you know, I think for a lot of us, these realizations began in earnest, came to the form of a comeuppance in 2016 with the political realities that came to bear in those days, and have matured over the last 10 years to less of a pendulum swing and more of a realization of where we actually are in the world. And it's not a new place, and it's not a place I shouldn't have expected. And having synthesized a lot of these ideas, I just want to put them in a form that might make sense to everyone I'm around, because it has, in my own heart and in my own mind, come to a head in a way that's helped me to realize where I am, where I need to be, helped me to understand my Christianity better, and helped me to understand my relationships better and my social standing better and the purpose of my not only calling and ministry, but also my vocation and my role in Christian higher education and so on. So for all those reasons, I kind of want this to come together and make sense. So it is theological and ethical, and those, you know, those two worlds of my commitment to the calling that I have and the relationship I have with God and what I think he's wanted to do with my life and hopefully has done some of with my life, the intersection between that and my understanding of ethics and the things that fundamentally make something right or wrong and how that bears out in the way we live together in a society, I think where those two things come together is what this episode is about. So, you know, let me lay it down first as a sort of a theological landmark. And I don't mean by that landmarkism, the way we talk about it, for those of you who know the term, in fundamentalism and stuff like that. But this is, I mean, it is something that a landmarkist might look back on and say, oh yeah, I've always thought that. And it is a theological landmark. It is something of an important statement. And it has to do with the understanding that the world just isn't ever going to be perfect until Christ comes back, until the eschaton, until somehow God makes everything right in the world. And I think that's built into the faith of Judaism. I've been talking about it in the Psalms ad nauseum. Well, maybe it's not ad nauseum for everyone, but I'm sure for some of you, it's like, let it go, man. I would, but the Psalms just keep going back to it anyway, that reality that the world is not a perfect place, isn't going to be a perfect place until God comes and makes everything perfect in a final and in some ways catastrophic event takes place. But it's not, you know, not a single catastrophic event, but it's that one great, and then for believers, not catastrophic at all, one rescuing, redeeming eschatological event that brings the divine and perfect conclusion to everything, the end of evil and suffering and so on. I do have a perspective of the world that matches that. And theologically, that perspective is present in any, so I want to say respectable, I mean that, but I don't mean by it that we wouldn't recognize the dignity of people who hold a different view. But I think, you know, the real forms of Christianity, and I know that can be an insulting statement, but it is sort of what I mean. They all have that perspective built into them in one way or another. And I don't, and I'm not talking about some modern recent confession of faith or even the Baptist faith and message or something along those lines. I just mean, if you look back creedally, in the Nicene Creed itself, you know, one of the most fundamental statements of what Christianity is in its core, in the middle of all of those statements, you know, we believe in God the Father and, you know, Jesus the Son and so on, is this. And this is in the middle and then toward the conclusion of the statement in the Nicene Creed, where it says, and we believe that he will come again in glory to judge the living and the dead. So there is a need for that. There's a need for something to happen involving judgment, and his kingdom will have no end. That what's established is a place where that judgment's been realized and is no longer anticipated. It's actually being experienced. And even that is solidified in a statement later in the Nicene Creed toward the conclusion, where it says, and I look forward to the resurrection of the dead and the life of the world to come. Meaning this world is not the conclusion of the matter. Things are not perfect here, but what we look forward to is a resurrection where things are made better. The contrast between the way things are now and the way they will be when God makes everything right, including when he raises the dead, is an inherent, important, even essential part of Christianity. And even if I put it in the more common Apostles' Creed, and a simpler statement, it is this, and it's the same idea as in the Nicene Creed. He will come to judge the living and the dead. I believe in the resurrection of the body and life everlasting. All of that is this declaration that there's something beyond the way things are right now. That's why there's judgment. And the thing beyond it is better, which is why there is life everlasting, not as, oh no, we're going to have to endure this forever. That's not what we mean by life everlasting. What we mean by life everlasting is perfection, this glory that we've always been anticipating. It's just built into Christianity that that contrast is there. And in practical terms, those are just creedal identifiers for this idea that the world's not a perfect place. In practical terms, it's always been an important part of Christianity. It's not essential in the same way, this idea, this concept or doctrine. It's not essential in the same way that Christ's resurrection is essential to the identity and personality of Christianity. The lordship of Jesus is essential to Christianity. But it is essential to Christianity in the sense that if you want to have a faithful model of historical Christianity and what it has always meant, then it includes this idea. This world isn't perfect and won't be until Christ comes back. And that idea is even present after Christ's resurrection. Things are not perfect, but Jesus will come back in the future. And his return will end the power of evil, and his return will end the weight for vindication that the righteous have always had. That's just built into the nature of Christianity, and as we've seen demonstrated in the Psalms over these last few months, it's built into the nature of Judaism as well. And that underlying theological landmark, the world's not perfect, it's never going to be perfect, there's nothing we will ever do here that will make it perfect until God does something, and we believe it's in the form of his return. until God does something to make it all right in the end. That's built into the world. That, I think, is built into my theology. It has been built into my theology for the last, 53 years, since I was 9 years old or so. Ethically, what that means is more of a landmine than a landmark. It creates some real conundrums for us. And when I say ethically as in contrast to theologically, I mean in the practical way that we're going to play out our lives as people who want to be faithful to justice, to truth, to righteousness in the world. And we want to do that because of our theological commitments, but we need to do it in practical terms. What does this mean I do with my resources? What does it mean I do with my vote? What does it mean I do with my neighbor when they steal something from me? What does it mean I do to protect my neighbor when someone's stealing something from them, and so on? All of those questions are the ethical questions that we have, and those questions change depending on whether you believe the world can be a perfect place. If we just did everything right, everything would be okay. Or if you believe that's not possible. And the difference is much bigger than simply saying, well, you're just a pessimist. You just don't think the world can ever be right. It's not that simple, because there are plenty of people who don't believe the world can be a perfect place, but still believe they can make the world a better place and believe that that's important to do. And so ethically, we have some questions to answer and figure out in order to know what it means for us. So I think the most important part of the contrasts that are available and how to interpret the ethics in light of that theological understanding, I think it's best realized in this adage, and I think it comes out this way all the time. I hear this as sort of the regular proverb that's trotted out to make this point theologically about how we apply our ethics to the world. And I think this adage that I'm going to give you is applied in different ways, but it sort of covers the range of what are legitimate responses here. And the adage is simply, the poor you always have with you. You know, you've heard this 1,000 times. If you haven't, you will now, because people use it for this point all the time. And it comes from at least 3 of the Gospels. I'm not sure if it's in Luke now that I think back on it, but I know it's in Matthew, Mark, and John, for different reasons. And it's used a little differently in each context. In Matthew and Mark, obviously, more similarly than in John, where it really seems like almost a different story, but it's not, I don't think. So in Matthew 26, I'm going to give it to you in this form. It comes when Jesus is, and you know, this is obviously after the triumphal entry and all the things have been going on. We're headed towards the crucifixion. So when Jesus was in Bethany, he's traveling back and forth from Jerusalem to Bethany on a regular basis, right, during that Passion Week. When Jesus was in Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, I'm reading to you from Matthew 26:6. There came to him a woman having an alabaster box of very precious ointment, poured it on his head as he sat at meat. You'll remember this. And when his disciples saw it, they had indignation. Now we know from John, this is Judas that has the primary indignation, but obviously, he's had an influence on the other disciples, and so Matthew tells us about that. So when his disciples saw it, they had indignation and said, to what purpose is this waste? For this ointment might have been sold for much good and given to the poor. And when Jesus understood it, he said to them, why are you troubling this woman? She has wrought a good work on me. You have the poor always with you, but me you don't always have with you. For in that she hath poured this ointment on my body, she did it for my burial. Verily I say to you, wheresoever this gospel shall be preached in the whole world, there shall also this that this woman has done be told for a memorial of her. And then one of the 12, called Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priest. I read you that last part just to make the point again that even in Matthew, it's sort of recognized Judas is the one beating the drum on this issue. And we know that he has a cheap reason for wanting to do it from John, where he tells us about it. But the intended purpose of the rebuke that they want to give the woman, wow, you're wasting all this money. We could take care of the poor with this money. That's a legitimate concern. The ethical concern for the poor is what they use to cloak whatever other concerns they might have for what's going on. But the reality of what they're doing is also revealed in the text. And so that's why in Matthew, it becomes obvious that the real reason they have the rebuke, and Jesus corrects them for this, is because they're thinking to themselves, oh, well, we have a resource and we need to use it. And it's this pragmatic desire to solve problems their own way. Now, that's Matthew generously interpreting what's going on with the disciples and Jesus rebuking only this in the disciples in Matthew's account. And so, you know, when Jesus says to them, hey, you know, I'm here and she's done something good for me, he's making the point to them that it doesn't matter what the value of it was, because what God is able to do through Christ is much more valuable than everything they would do with all the money they could get from that alabaster box and so on. And so their sort of petty economic perspective on how to solve problems makes them blind to the reality of what God can do when people are just obedient to him and when they care about the right things and so on. So Matthew points it out that way. Of course, John points it out by Judas's self-dealing. Judas is like, hey, I'm holding the purse. We could have sold that. It would have been more money in my pocket. And, you know, he's just completely selfish about it. And Matthew just barely tips his hat to that at the very end of the account when he says, you know, one of the 12 called Judas Iscariot then goes to the chief priest, that's what motivates Judas to go ahead and, you know, turn on Jesus at that point. Not that he wasn't already turned against him, but you get the point I'm making. Now, that's just background to say, on the theological side, Jesus makes the statement, you always have the poor with you in this statement. I know and you know, in the immediate discourse there, that Jesus is not making some eschatological statement. He's not trying to make some universal declaration about the condition of humankind for all of history. He's simply saying, you know, the poor are around you guys all the time. You've had the opportunity to go and take the money that's in your purse right now and go spend it on them. And yet you're sitting here eating with me while this woman comes in to do this. So don't go blaming her for this. You know, in terms of the discourse, that's all that's really going on. But from the moment Jesus says these words, his followers and all of us who are his followers have heard it to also say, in reality, you're always going to have the opportunity to focus on the imperfections that are in the world, the suffering that's happening in the world. You not only have had the poor with you all along that you could have been serving while you're with me, but you will have the poor with you all along. Whatever you think of that interpretation and expansion of the meaning of what Jesus said there, that is how it has been taken and expanded since he said it. And I think there are plenty of other theological groundings in Scripture that are perfect justifications for saying, and it's going to be that way. The suffering is going to be present in the world, and there's nothing that can undo it. So I'm not going to debate the theological point on the point of exegesis from the text. I don't need to do that. What I wanted you to see, though, what I want you to notice in that confrontation that takes place is the convergence of these two realities. If you say eschatologically, well, the poor are always going to be here. There is always going to be a suffering class, pure religion and undefiled, before God and the Father is this, to visit the fatherless and widows in their affliction. To say that affliction is what defines our religion also means we've got to deal ethically with what our obligations are in the world if it can't be made perfect. Your ethic is different if you believe in a perfection that is attainable here and now than it will be if you believe that really, and I'm saying that in the context of realism as an ethic, really we can't obtain perfection. We have to work with what we have. We have to play the cards we've been dealt and so on. That model sort of changes what we expect to come out of our ethical commitments. And in socially, our ethical commitments end up being expressed largely politically. So what I want to do is have a conversation about what this means politically and socially and ethically for those of us who care about all of those things, but are grounded fundamentally by our theological, religious, spiritual, Christian commitments and convictions. So politically, what this has led to is a synthesis for me, especially since, as I mentioned before, the comeuppance that I've had since 2016 or so. And it's not that brief a comeuppance. I mean, it took decades for God to slap me around enough to get me to pay attention to what was going on and actually be changed by the Spirit that he was providing abundantly that I should have been listening to begin with. So if I talk about that synthesis, the way to get there is it's a little convoluted, but I think we can get there reasonably. And even today, and I know this will take more than one episode to get to, but even today, I think we can get to the point where you'll understand why I'm talking about this and, you know, what the basic shape of my synthesis is. And I'm not saying this like I have found the answer, but I am saying this like I've been observing this for 5 decades now, and in all of that time have learned some things that have changed my way of understanding politics and the world and my Christian expression in a way that I hope will be somewhat helpful to those who are coming behind. I wish somebody had said some of these things to me. I say that. I'm gonna say it and then I'll correct it, okay? So I wish somebody had said this to me when I was 16 years old. I wish somebody had said these things to me when I was 24 years old. And if they had, I think I would have taken a different approach. I think I would have been able to apply my Christianity in a sense that was more representative of how Christ treated me. And that's what I wish I had done. Now, I'll go back and say, I have no doubt people were screaming this into my face and saying, what are you doing? Listen to me. This is how it is. Because as I look back on it, some of those people are the people who are helping me rethink about this now as I read them now and as I pay attention to the things they said. So, you know, it's always easy for us to say, if somebody had just told me. I hear that all the time from people who I told those things, for instance. So I know I probably ignored these messages. Sorry about that to those you ignored. Anyway, here's the thing I would start with. First of all, I'm in my saying all of this, I'm not being apocalyptic. I'm going to sound like it in some ways because I am saying to you, one of the things that this comeuppance has made me realize is we're not going to arrive at some ideal conclusion at some point where we finally have the right person in office. That's just never going to happen. I realize that. And so you might think that when I'm saying, oh, well, the 2024 election, you know, it's just going to be catastrophic. You might think, oh, he's predicting an apocalypse. I'm not. And I mean, sincerely, I'm not being apocalyptic. I don't foresee the end of all good things coming because we have these catastrophic circumstances that are arising. I don't need to be that. And yet I do see the current circumstance as extremely serious and critically grave in its nature. So why am I not being apocalyptic? Well, first of all, because I lived in that world where people were predicting apocalypses with every single political outcome for decades. And I knew every single time that it was false. I knew before the elections it was false, and I saw after the elections that it was false time after time after time. And that's on both sides. Utopia did not follow Reagan's election in 1980 or 1984 or even the follow-up to that with H.W. Bush's election in 1988. Now, and you can say, we had unbelievable success. I mean, we ended the Cold War, did we? I mean, look where we are right now. Did we really end it? I mean, I understand the point. I get the tearing down of the Berlin Wall. Hallelujah. Good things happen. Did it end all of the things that we were trying to end in reality? I learned that just wasn't the case when when Republicans won, and for me, this was we, you know, for the Republicans to win the not only the presidency, but both houses, and now to have a majority on the Supreme Court of conservative justices, everything's going to be, and it wasn't. It just was, and it never was. It never happened that way. And by the way, democracy's death didn't follow 1992's election or 1996's election, or as it turns out, 2008 or 2012 and so on, when the Democrats would have predicted a utopia coming, or the Republicans an apocalypse coming because of the outcome of the elections. And so, you know, in 2008, everybody in the United States didn't suddenly find themselves waking up in a communist nation, nor did the United States cede its entire sovereignty to the UN General Assembly, who now come into your home and tell you how to raise your children. I mean, have mercy on me. Okay, so I heard all those apocalyptic predictions, and I'm not doing any of that. I'm out of that altogether. The harm, and by the way, the harm in that kind of rhetoric, that kind of apocalyptic rhetoric, the world's not, and it's going terrible, and if you vote for that person, look what it's going to do to our nation, and we're going to lose America, we're not going to have it anymore. That kind of language is obviously harmful when it hits the fringe of our society. Most people don't mean it this way. Most people don't want to experience it this way. But the reason you have an Oklahoma City bomber or an El Paso supermarket shooter or the shooter up in Buffalo, it's because they hear this inflamed apocalyptic rhetoric and they believe it, they buy it, and they can't find their way out of it. And by the way, one of the weird things to me is how many non-fringe members of our society right now, people who you would think are right in the core of regular daily life, are having a hard time finding their way out of the apocalyptic language. That's sad to me, because you don't need to be trapped in that. It's just not a realistic perspective on the world. Not because things aren't grave and not because they're not important, but because our expectation of what happens as a result of our political activities is not realistic. Not in terms of our theology, our theological commitments. If I didn't have the theological commitments, I don't know where I'd be on this stuff. And I have a deep philosophical basis to my ethic in Kantian ethics. I still don't know. I don't know if I could be there without the theological grounding that I have in it. So if I'm not being apocalyptic, you know, like, hey, I've realized there's no hope in politics, and you know, if I'm not just being Eeyore, and it's all going down from here, if I'm not being that, what am I doing? And part of what I'm doing is coming to terms with a catastrophic disappointment in, I'm just going to bear it all today, and in this way, sort of make my points, and some of this will seem too dense, and some of it may seem too simplistic. But in reality, I'm just coming to terms with a catastrophic disappointment that I've had in the sociopolitical aspirations I acquired as a teenager. And I had what I felt like were laudable sociopolitical aspirations, what I wanted society to become, what I wanted to happen in that society. It was all, and it was rooted in my theology. Because of my theology, I knew the poor would always be with us. For me, that interpreted itself into the idea that sin would always persist. That's redundant. Persistence means it keeps going. Anyway, that sin would persist. That, you know, idiomatic errors would always follow. That I'm always going to say things that are redundant. That struggle and suffering would persist. That perfection would not arrive in the world. That's what that meant to me, and that's how I've expressed it going forward. But there are, and by the way, there are a lot of ways to understand why those problems persist. It doesn't have to be theological. And I'm not going to dwell on this one, but by the time we get to the end, this is fairly important. You know, another way to explain why the poor are always with us, or why sin always, you know, persists redundantly, or why suffering always continues, is because human existence is competitive. It's evolutionary. I don't hold this model for reality, but I mean, I do in the scientific sense because it's a decent paradigm for explaining the world, but not in a realistic sense. Theologically, I believe in the creation and God who governs all of this stuff. And that makes perfect sense to me that God is doing this. But I understand in evolutionary terms, you can explain why what we call sin theologically, they would just say, it's just the nature of the competitive struggle to survive and the powerful overcoming the weak and so on. And in that evolutionary struggle, you can think of Nietzsche's ethic of power, the ethic of power, just whoever's strongest should use their power and so on. So you can explain it in other terms and say, well, of course, you're always going to have these kinds of struggles. And you might have some Marxist ideological imagination of an eschaton where everyone shares all things, evenly. But, you're never really going to get there. I mean, if you do, it's millennia away. And if you try to get there, you create the catastrophes that prevent you from getting there. I'll describe that later on. But because of this is me growing up, I'm talking about, because of my Americanism, and I don't mean that in a bad way or a good way. I just mean the reality that I grew up in Americana. I remember one of my proudest moments as a child was being in fourth grade and putting on an Abraham Lincoln getup costume, which also became something of an Uncle Sam costume because it was all red, white, and blue and top hat-ish. But I also had the beard from Abraham Lincoln, not Uncle Sam. It wasn't white. I don't know why. And all the decorations on my bicycle, and I won the 4th of July parade for best decoration in Arlington, Texas, which was the largest July 4th parade in the state of Texas at the time. That's good enough. So that was my pride. I grew up in that kind of Americana. I loved it, and I thought the world of it. But because of that Americanism sort of built into me, I thought of our country in a way I think a lot of us probably do, that our bubble of prosperity and justice and righteousness and equity and so on is the exception within history. And in some ways, we are an exception within history. I'm not even disagreeing with that. But I thought of it in the same way that, an evolutionist would think of evolution on Earth as an exception to the chaos within the cosmos, that everything is fading into oblivious random everywhere, except where we have this one little bubble of interrupting carbon atoms interacting in such a way that they become this and that and finally turns into us, in evolution. And that will eventually collapse into the randomness of the rest of the universe also. That way of thinking of American success in this world that inevitably is evil, but has these little bubbles of good that pop up. And so there's the American bubble that popped up in goodness right now. Sort of like a Mary Poppins kind of just shows up, and it's a better part of the world. That was my way of thinking of American success. And I think it's the way we're taught about it, even now among ourselves. And we think of ourselves as having, for instance, a representative government that's so well implemented here that we actually have progress toward equality, where justice is equally distributed so that everyone is able to experience liberty, that we thought of ourselves having such a fine form of representative government and so well protected by the balance of powers that progress towards equality was inevitable, a perdurable realization of the American dream. This is how we often do think of ourselves right now. And again, I'm extremely grateful for the blessings that I have in this country. And I was thinking that right and wrong was about good intentions and evil intentions. Good people, right people, were people who intended to do good. And evil people were people who intended, to tie down the poor victim of a woman on the train track and let the train sever her body into several pieces. That's what evil was for us. That was a cartoon image, not a real image. So, I had confidence in a lot of political ideals based on the good intentions. And I think they were sincerely good intentions of the people I knew who worked toward those ends and also knew the people who were affecting the means towards those ends. So, I mean, right was just about trying your best to do the best you could do to get the best result you could get. But because of my comeuppance, you know, I've realized that it's not, America's not a bubble. That doesn't mean we're not extremely blessed and not the greatest country in the history of the world. I'm not saying we're not that. I think we are. But we're not a bubble in the reality of evil's presence. As blessed as America is, and we are emphatically so blessed, it is not fundamentally different than the way the rest of the cosmos is, if I were to go back to the metaphor. We are blessed in our prosperity. We're blessed for me. I'm sitting in a really nice room with a nice microphone and a really nice producer on occasion, most of the time. Anyway, so the point is, I've got all kinds of blessings. And we have, as a nation, world prominence and incredible security. But in a different sense, we're not different than the rest of the world. I'll speak a lot more about that below. But, you know, in a sense, we're not, and I had said three things above about the ways that we realize the blessings that are ours, that we are a bubble, that we're realizing progress toward perfect justice, and that our way of thinking about good and evil is just well-intentioned people or ill-intentioned people. All three of those are what I'm addressing here. Number one, we're not a bubble. We're not different than the rest of the world. I'll explain. Ethically, theologically, we shouldn't think we're a bubble. We're humans. Human beings all have these attributes. To have an anthropology that's Christian means we're just dealing with people the same way the rest of the world deals with people. Secondly, we're not realizing progress toward perfect justice. Our representation here, remember we had said we might be doing that because our representational government is just so great. Well, our representation here is as fraught and fragile as it must by its own nature be in any place where it's attempted. And again, I'm going to pause here and say, I'm not a pessimist about these things. This is not me being apocalyptic. Well, our government's bound to fail because it's whatever. This whole discussion, and I mean the whole discussion, however long it takes, is not about me giving up. You know, let's just finally realize this is a terrible place and we ought to all just be okay with misery. I'm not advocating for that at all. This is me coming to terms with where I am and where I realize we are as a society and where we are politically. Not me giving up on where we are. So if I pick it back up, I would be saying, you know, the reason I would say our representation here is as fraught and fragile as it is by its own nature, because anywhere it's attempted, this is true about it. Society is always larger than individuals. This is nothing more than a rehashing of anyone who studies a society, whether Freud or Marx or Weber or anybody else. And yes, even people who are wrong are right about things. Society is larger than individuals. Governments exist in order to impose society's will on individuals. Inevitably, the society intrudes on the individual. It can take a lot of different forms. I mean, it might take the form of saying, all right, well, whoever's strongest is just going to push the weak into the corner there and do what they want to do, the tyranny of the strong. You could have I'm going to use the word tyranny here about the ill forms that these can take. They don't always have to take an ill form. Obviously, a person can be benevolent and exercise the same kind of authority. But I'll use tyranny to talk about the negative side of it, right? So the tyranny of the strong, you could have the tyranny of the chosen. We do that throughout history with divine right. Oh, well, who am I to question the king that God has put into the position of authority? And David's not run out of being king because he turns against the people in this way or that way. He's run out of being king because Absalom wants to become the next king in the divine right. He thinks he is the one who's chosen to be next, and so on. Or You can have a tyranny of the majority. It's just a different form of tyranny. And I do mean, again, that's only given the evil side of it. I'm not saying the majority always has to act evilly, but they are the ones exerting authority and power over the people who have a little less representation. And so I'm bringing it back to us where we say, oh, in this bubble, we have representational government, so evil's just going to disappear. No, power's just put itself into a different form. And how that ends up being expressed is still going to be a statement within which a society says to an individual, sit down, shut up, sit in the corner, and do what we tell you to do, because you don't get a say in this, because now you have to cooperate with us. That's what societies are about. Now, again, it doesn't always have to be evil, but it is always going to come into that kind of confrontation, because, and this is why, and by I'll say more about that down below. But the other way that we're not perfect, that I've realized in this, you know, recognition of where we are, is that it's not just about who has good intentions and who has evil intentions. Don't misunderstand me here. And I realize we're running short on time for the first episode, first run at this. But I do want to be clear here. I'm not saying it's not about good and evil. There's good and evil. And there's a nice hard line between good and evil. That's not a problem. Our problem is understanding what makes something good or what makes something evil. So this is about good and evil. It's just not in our shallow, simplistic way of thinking about what those things are. And in this particular issue resides the crux of the point where I want us to arrive in our overall discussion. This is as far as we're going to get today, but I just want you to hear this part. That being confronted by Christ's teachings and his actions should shake us from the political dogmatism and lethargy that made us think we had the right answer and we're in a bubble and we can get where no one in all of history has ever gotten before, but we can get there. All of that simplicity should be confronted by Christ himself if we're aware of what he taught us. And on this issue about motives, and that's what this is all ultimately about, that the way we see evil and good in the world by saying, well, that person's evil, they just want to bring about evil results in the world. And, oh, well, these people, they're trying to do good. Oh, yeah, they've made some mistakes, but they're trying to do good. So these are good people. Jesus does not allow us to conclude about good and evil that kind of simplistic conclusion. He doesn't allow us to arrive there. And by the way, on that issue, I'm going to say her name again. I'm going to give thanks again. On this issue about motives and what it is that defines good and evil, I will always most deeply and persistently be indebted to Hannah Arendt. There's nobody who confronted me more abruptly about it. And that happened, by the way, while I was still on my PhD program, writing my dissertation. That's when I read The Banality of Evil and understood what was going on and began this descaling of my own eyes about the things I ought to think regarding these issues. So at the core of it, where I want us to get in the next one or two discussions that we have about this is to a point where we understand Jesus looking at us and saying, oh, you thought he was evil because he said X and Y? And you thought, oh, you're good because you're trying to pursue A and B. You need to see beyond what your shallow motives tell you about yourself and about others to the truth of what I've told you in the simplest terms will be your act of obedience to me, that you love me and that you love the people who are around you, because that's what I've done for you while I walked among you. Jesus teaches us a lesson. It's so simple to learn. And so difficult to learn. But I want us to talk about it some more next time.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.